everyone. Welcome back to Progressively Incorrect. My name is Zach Groeschel. I'm so excited today to have the return of one of the most requested and most listened to guests in the history of this, this five-year show, Christopher Such. We're going to be kind of getting updates on what he's been working on lately. The world of literacy has exploded, I feel like, in new debates, and it's time for me to update my knowledge. I hope you feel the same. I just real quick wanted to plug an event that's coming up that is sponsored by StepLab. As you know, StepLab is a coaching and PD platform that I use with all of my schools and that 14,000 students, schools, excuse me, with like 100,000 students are using right now across England and the United and Australia and the United States. That event is called the Explicit Teaching Institute in New York City. It is the last week of July of 2026. I'd love for you to come. I'm leading the thing for a week of explicit instruction training for teachers and for principals, and we're going to be using a lot of the video content from StepLab. It's just a really great opportunity to get to the greatest city in the world, New York City. With that being said, let's get into our conversation with my guest. Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm great, thanks. All the better for being invited back on. Like being a repeat guest, yeah, it feels like a real privilege.
I really wanted to talk to you because of a few different reasons. One of those at the end, we'll talk about some of the work you've been doing with StepLab. But before that, there has been a new surge in the reading wars, as I would say, around a few topics here. Should we just kind of jump into the first one?
Yeah, go for it. I'm excited to annoy unintentionally as many people as I possibly can.
Well, you know how when the pendulums swing and nobody really specifies what they actually mean by certain design choices and things like that when it comes to reading, is that a lot of people are left with a lot of confusing advice. And so there's been a lot of growing talk in schools around too much phonics. And I'd say that's almost internal in the structured literacy, the explicit instruction sort of side of things, is that perhaps some kids who do not have a reading disability or are just, you know, typically developing and so on, they don't need as much phonics as perhaps we're giving them. And you hear a lot of things like this term escape velocity. Can you maybe unpack this new round of conversations in the world of phonics teaching?
Yeah, I mean, in order to do that, I think it's really important to start with the foundation of what I'm talking about when I talk about like systematic phonics. Like the purpose of phonics, let's be really clear about that, isn't to just teach reading more broadly. The purpose of phonics is quite precise. It is to teach pupils how to begin to decode. And that means teaching some relationships between letters and sounds, the most common ones, the most useful ones that exist in the English writing system, and how to use them. And there is a debate, as you say, about, well, how much of that should we teach? For how long should we teach that stuff? And behind that is the understanding that if phonics is just teaching enough of the alphabetic code and how to use it so that kids can reach this escape velocity that I'll unpack a little bit more in a minute, then that's as far as we need to go. That's all the explicit teaching we need to do. What does this escape velocity thing mean? Well, what people are talking about is the idea that if the purpose of phonics is just to get kids to know enough of the code and how to use it, then how much is enough and what comes next? So the point is, if we teach it enough in inverted commas of the code and how to use it, kids can then start to use what they've learned to then learn through experiences with authentic texts, the wider complexities of the English writing system. Now, sometimes when I hear this like escape velocity talked about, I get the impression that people think once you've reached this point where kids have the habit of decoding, if you like, and enough knowledge to sustain that habit, that once you get there, all you need to do is get kids doing independent reading or, you know, teach them how to answer certain comprehension questions or build their knowledge of the world or whatever it might be. The reality of this escape velocity as such is that actually there's still a load of scaffolded reading experience, like decoding practice, that kids need to do and often need support with in order to get somewhere. And behind this discussion, this idea of the escape velocity, the point, in other words, at which kids have this habit and have enough knowledge to sustain this decoding habit, Behind it is this idea that lots of kids are getting far too much phonics. We're going beyond that escape velocity. Now, when I hear about what's happening in certain American schools, I have some sympathy with that idea. I've spoken to educators who say that kids are getting maybe 3 years of systematic phonics instruction of 45 minutes a day. And when I compare that to the English education system, I find that, you know, kind of interesting to, and I see the argument that perhaps too much explicit teaching of phonics is potentially happening. However, if you'll forgive me, there's a bit of nuance behind this that I have to dive into to really explain it properly. So in the English education system, what you find is that the average school is teaching about 30 minutes of phonics per day. And then most kids, by the end of the second year of phonics instruction, so that's about 200 hours of teaching altogether, about 80 to 90% of kids at this stage, they've reached what you might describe as this escape velocity. The habit of decoding is there. They know enough of the alphabetic code for them to be able to take a sensible decoding attempt at most words, the vast majority of words they face, etc. And with that in mind, when I hear the idea that kids are learning more and more phonics than that in some American settings, then I start to have some sympathy. Where there is some nuance in this argument is that there are reasons why you might continue to teach what's sometimes thought of as phonics, including the teaching of morphology. Sometimes this is wrapped up with what people are thinking about when they're thinking about the teaching of phonics. There are reasons why you might continue to teach that long after escape velocity. You might be teaching that as part of explicit teaching of spelling. But the key thing is, once kids have reached this, in inverted commas, escape velocity, that's the point at which you can unapologetically be putting lots of wonderful, meaningful texts in front of them and asking them to decode them with your support. And so if you are doing that and kids are getting these experiences with texts, but you're still doing some systematic, what's thought of at least as systematic phonics teaching, it isn't necessarily problematic. What's problematic is how long are you delaying this point before kids are getting into meaningful texts? The final thing to say about this is that this is all about values and compromises. Because if you've got a class of 30 kids in front of you and you start teaching all of them systematic phonics, you are going to have some kids in that room who arrived already able to read. They arrived at school able to read because of the experiences they've had with their parents, how easy they find it to learn the alphabetic code from looking at it and reading with their parents or hearing their parents read, etc., etc. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you're going to have some kids who need far more than 200 hours of explicit instruction. They might need like 1,000 hours of explicit instruction to get to the same place, to get to that escape velocity. So deciding how much is the right amount of phonics for like mainstream classrooms depends on like what percentage of kids do you want to get to that escape velocity before you say, we're not teaching phonics in the classroom anymore, and now it's down to tier two, tier three provision into interventions, etc. I don't think it's easy to say exactly how you should balance that. But the final thing to say is, like, just looking at the hundreds of schools I've worked with and seeing phonics taught and having taught phonics myself, I do think that a pretty sensible balance would be to say around 200 hours of explicit phonics teaching done well will get 80 to 90% of your kids to that point where they don't necessarily need more phonics teaching for the purposes of reading. And usually once you're down to that final 10, 15, 20% of kids, that's usually, I think, a small enough group where you can start to say, OK, now this is a small group, or if entirely necessary, like a one-to-one thing. I know I've been talking, there's so much to unpack about this conversation, but ultimately, I have sympathy for this idea of this metaphor of of escape velocity. But we need to recognize that there are practicalities involved with this. And often these practicalities connect to people's values and the resources that they have available in their classroom to deliver interventions.
Love it. Let me unpack some of those things, because I feel like I should just go play, you know, go off the cuff for some of these, because there's a lot of my own experience I can bring into this. One of those is like that I think we saw this with comprehension strategy versus knowledge debates and things like that. One is that we really do not have a good idea of how much anyone is doing anything in a country as large as this one, right? One of the things that's really interesting to me is that when people would say, like, yeah, I'm seeing 45 minute this, this, and that, and I know that their job is not observing classrooms like mine currently is, and I go, I can hardly find a teacher who can hold attention for more than 20 minutes, let alone try to crank out a 45 minute phonics lesson, right? I haven't seen one of those lessons in a while, but maybe you are. It's a big place. Maybe we can all agree that that 45 minute, like third grade phonics lesson is absolute overkill, or it's just an inappropriately sequenced curriculum. I find that piece interesting.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that one of the advantages of the English education system, and at points disadvantages as well, but one of the things that sometimes plays to our advantage is how centralized it is. There will be discrepancies around England in terms of systematic phonics instruction, but every school is teaching systematic phonics instruction to every pupil for at least the first 2 years. They are using phonics programs that have been looked at and validated by the Department for Education. There are systems in place to make sure that not only are teachers teaching phonics, but they know which pupils are struggling with it down the line and need further support. And so we have this really centralized system. And so when I hear conversations with American educators, what amazes me, as you say, is the huge discrepancies that can exist within schools that are actually, in some cases, not that far away from each other. So I appreciate that different states are bringing in certain mandates relating to like evidence-informed reading instruction, etc. But yeah, I hear the idea that there's this huge variety of stuff. And just the final thing to note about that is with there are element areas of reading where evidence is our friend. For example, the fact that it is a good idea almost certainly to teach. Explicitly teach the alphabetic code or some of the alphabetic code and how to use it, there's a massive consensus on that. And when you look at the research papers behind it, you see where that consensus comes from. But in terms of how much of the alphabetic code should we teach and for how long, essentially there's nothing. Essentially, you'll see almost nothing that compares programs. Like the closest that exists is research from Solity et al. That looks into different. Scopes and sequences for phonics instruction and basically says, like, if you teach this much, then this percentage of words that exist in kids' books will be transparent to kids. If you teach this much, then a higher percentage, etc. And they basically suggest that understandably there's diminishing returns because you're teaching the most useful stuff at first, and the more grapheme, phoneme correspondences you teach, the more you're getting into ones that are a bit more niche. And the less commonly you'll see them in words. But beyond that, and even that would take a huge amount of interpretation to start saying, this means I do X, Y, and Z. Beyond that, we're given almost no guidance from research about how much of the code we should teach, how long we should teach it for. And even if research did start to look at that for your average pupil or your average class, there's still a whole variety of pupils with different levels of prior knowledge, different initial capabilities to take into account. And so you can't even then assume if research does look into this with mainstream classrooms that that it will apply to the class of kids you've got in front of you. So yeah, it's not an area where evidence is our friend at this point.
And you mentioned the word escape velocity can imply for some people that it's binary. Like basically, like once you've hit it, blast off, baby, right? Let's go into some texts and let's stop. But we know that the English language with prefixes and suffixes and Latin roots and all this morphological instruction, we know that some level of word work or word recognition instruction goes on often into the middle years, even where we study for our SAT tests or whatever. Understanding how the language works is to a great benefit to high school students. And so, like this idea that like all of a sudden a switch is flipped, and you just stop dealing with words in very small sort of mini lessons, you just kind of only get into text. That sounds off to me. And you kind of touched on that a little bit.
Yeah, and there's two parts to that. I mean, we often talk about phonics and we end up ignoring the fact that we're talk that Phonics isn't just systematic phonics. Like if I'm working with a 13-year-old and they said to me, "How do I spell light? How do I spell light as in light bulb?" Well, I'm going to make explicit the fact that the I sound of that word is spelled IGH. And in doing so, that's phonics. I'm making it clear that, part of our writing system involves these relationships between letters and sounds, and I'm teaching that for the purposes of reading and spelling. So that's phonics in some form. But as you say, there's also huge value in word study, not just for the spelling or, sorry, not just for the learning around spelling, which is useful for writing, etc., but also for just understanding the meaning behind words. So if someone said to me, part of our the work that we do with 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds is intentionally teaching aspects of morphology, and where necessary, we're making connections to grapheme-phoneme correspondences, I wouldn't say, "Oh, well, that's very silly. There's no need to do that because, they've reached an escape velocity." It's like, no, there's still potential value to that. The other thing, if we really want to be like brutal towards this metaphor, because metaphors are always limited by, by definition. They always break apart at the edges. So I'm perhaps being a bit unfair to it, because I do think it has use as a metaphor. One of the other possible issues with it is that escape velocity, as you su suggest, or sorry, as you say, suggests this idea that, you're out of the atmosphere and there's no longer any form of friction, because that's what we mean by an escape velocity. There's no longer any friction. You're just there, and it doesn't require any more force to keep traveling in the same direction. But the problem with this, amongst other things, is that it's quite possible for kids to reach what you might think of as an escape velocity. It looks like they've got the habit of decoding. You've taught them enough code knowledge so that when they get to a word like wasp, even if they say wasp, they've decoded through the entire word and now got wasp and can take a sensible guess from it. Even if they've got to that stage, it might well be the case, and this does happen, that when this same kid starts to encounter more challenging text, that they start to go, "Oh," and like they fall back into the idea of, "Oh, I'm going to look at the first two set letters within this word and then take a guess based on the rest of it because it just looks quite complicated." In other words, kids can redevelop the counterproductive habit of partially decoding the word and then guessing the rest of it. It's almost as if you could escape from the atmosphere, but somehow through gravity be drawn back in enough. So it's not, in other words, escape velocity suggests a permanence that I don't think is always there for every pupil. And teachers need to be really vigilant to this idea of, like, when kids encounter an unfamiliar word, are they, as their first step, attempting to decode all the way through it and then using a sensible decoding attempt to then make sense of it alongside, at that point, potential understanding of meaning, context, etc. But are they, as I say, decoding through the entire word to begin with? And kids can fall out of that habit. So as I say, teachers need to be vigilant to that. And maybe this idea of escape velocity hides that nuance a little bit.
Absolutely. I mentioned earlier how we don't really know what all teachers are doing in a system like this. Like, there's just so much variance in terms of schools and programs. And the program thing is the thing that really sticks to me with this as well, is that there are many teachers teaching in systems where you start with placement testing. The kids are put into smaller groups from the very beginning, and they basically mastery test to the next stage. And through that system in this country, this whole thing it's almost doesn't even seem like an argument that can be had, because you're telling me there's too much phonics, and we say, well, this is our scope and sequence, and every kid started at a different entry point, and they all got through in 2 years before they started getting into stuff that was much less focused on word recognition. While on the other hand, there are schools with nothing, no resources for teachers. The teachers sort of have to write what it is. Perhaps they are misinterpreting what the evidence suggests, or what people are telling them. Who knows? But anyway, I think we should move on from the question, but I find the whole thing a little bit tiring personally.
Just one final thing before we do move on from it. One thing I really liked, there was a blog recently by Professor Timothy Shanahan, and he put it much more diplomatically than I'm about to, but I think it's essentially the same point, which is that if you're going to say, "I think schools are teaching too much phonics," You need to be, if you're going to do that, you need to pin your colors to the mast and say, this is how much phonics, from my personal knowledge of this subject, I think is a sensible thing, like a sensible starting point. Even if you say, oh, there's going to be adaptations for individual pupils, different schools, depending on whether they take, like you say, a sort of small group based mastery approach. Yes, there's going to be adaptations. I'm not saying that no, there should be no nuance, but I think as a jumping off point, saying this seems like a sensible amount. This is a sensible amount of the alphabetic code. This is a sensible amount of hours. Or even if it's just, this program over there, that seems to do things in a sensible way. I think if you're going to say that there's too little or there's too much, you need to say what you mean by that. What does too much look like? Otherwise, all you're doing is allowing classroom teachers to read into your statement whatever they want, which might be, I think more than a month's worth of phonics is too much, and this guy's backing me up. And so, yeah, I think you have to be willing to be explicit about what you mean by too little and too much. If you think you know what too much is, fine, but by definition, that means you have a good idea of what correct is, and you have to make that clear as well.
Let's move to the next kind of area of debate. And this is so there's now this kind of talk around linguistic phonics versus, I'll be more specific, kind of like an Orton-Gillingham or a tradition, a structured literacy type of approach to phonics. And people are saying that linguistics phonics seems more intuitive. There's an element, and maybe it even connects back to how much phonics you teach. Can you maybe kind of unpack this for us, these new blogs coming out around these two approaches?
Yeah, I think to explore this, I'm going to have to lay another, like a bit of a foundation again, but this time about, what is meant when people talk about speech to print phonics versus print to speech. Now, there's a huge amount of misinformation around this subject, and as someone who has taught a speech, what's something that's defined as a speech to print program, that it was also defined as a linguistics phonics program, and has taught what might be described as a print to speech or traditional phonics program, I like to think I can unpack this to some extent. So, as we said before, systematic phonics is you're teaching some of the alphabetic code, so some of these grapheme-phoneme correspondences and how to use them. Now, because a grapheme-phoneme correspondence has both obviously a grapheme and a phoneme, when you think about how you might go about sequencing your curriculum, there are at two ex ends of the spectrum, two ways that you might organize it. You might say, I'm going to go purely print to speech. And what I mean by that is I'm going to start with print. I'm going to say, this is a grapheme. And once we get into the greater complexities of the English writing system, this is a grapheme. And these are the different sounds that this grapheme can spell. So, for example, the single letter grapheme, like the letter A, can spell A or A or and other variations. And so you could then go all the way through your curriculum on this basis. So this week we're looking at this grapheme and the different phoneme that it represents. Now you might not do that at first for the sake of simplicity, but at some point you're going to have to talk about this multiplicity between graphemes and phonemes. One way to organize that at an extreme end of the spectrum is to say, this week or whatever, we're doing this grapheme and the different sounds, the different phonemes it spells. At the other end of the spectrum is the opposite of that, where you say, well, let's organize it instead on the basis of phonemes. So instead of going, this week we're looking at this grapheme, it might be, this week we're looking at this phoneme, the sound A, and the different graphemes that spell it, which might be A I, A Y, A on its own. A sometimes described as a split digraph, A E, or E as a phonological marker, it's sometimes described as well. And at each end of the spectrum, those are different ways of organizing your curriculum. So speech to print, print to speech. But as I'm going to make clear in a moment, those are extremes. Those are extremes where you're all the way through organizing on the basis of letters first or on the basis of phonemes first. We then get to linguistic phonics versus traditional phonics. Now, broadly speaking, traditional phonics or Orton-Gillingham would be what you'd call print to speech. Generally speaking, the way that the curriculum is organized, starts with the graphemes, and then later on when you might get into the different ways that you spell those graphemes. Whereas linguistic phonics is generally, not always and entirely so, but generally has at least some bits of speech to print. Now, there are other bits and pieces that I will, if you'll forgive me, get into, but that's broadly what's going on here. That's broadly the debate. And there are reasons why we might think of each of those extremes as more plausible. Those who are into speech-to-print approaches, including linguistic phonics, will say, well, there's a logic to this. You know, kids arrive to school with speech, but often they don't arrive to school, or more often than not, they do anyway. They arrive with speech, and more often than not, they don't arrive, you know, necessarily knowing how this connects to letters. So if I start with speech, then I say to kids, look, you know this sound, and these are the ways that we can spell it. So that's one argument. There's like kind of the sense that it's more intuitive, or there's a logical underpinning behind that. I have to admit, I don't really buy that as an argument, because kids arrive knowing speech, but they don't arrive knowing phonemes. And those are two very different things. Phonemes are like abstract categories that we apply to different speech sounds. On the reverse side of that, you've got, you know, your traditional phonics types, your, if you like, print to speech. And an argument for that might be that, well, when kids are actually dealing with a word like wasp, say, and they get to that letter A, what is it that we want them to do? Well, when they see the letter A, that letter, that grapheme, I want them to then think about the different phonemes that that can represent. So that structure of the curriculum, where I start with the grapheme and then think of the different phonemes, might be more useful for actually decoding words. But you can also see how speech to print approaches might be more focused on, might be more useful for spelling words. Ultimately, these are extremes. There are linguistic phonics programs, including ones that I've used, that do both. That will have moments where you say, like this week, we're looking at this grapheme and all the different sounds it makes, or sounds it represents. I should be very careful there. All the different sounds it represents. But also, like the following week, it might do the reverse and say, okay, this is a particular sound and all the different graphemes that can represent it. So ultimately, this stuff is primarily about sequencing of your curriculum. And I think there are sensible middle grounds between speech to print and print to speech. However, this all gets more complicated when you look at some of the stuff that gets kind of wrapped into this. So what you call traditional phonics, or Orton Gillingham, for a long time in America seemed to be one of the only games in town for explicit phonics teaching. So understandably, people are attached to it. And there are elements of Orton Gillingham that don't really have much of an evidence base. And if anything, when you look into it, you think, I don't think this is a particularly sensible idea. Like the teaching of different, how to break up a word into open and closed syllables and speech and syllable types. There doesn't seem to be much evidence that that's a good idea compared to teaching pupils to flexibly break words into syllables. There's that element, but there's also kind of marketing, frankly. Like a lot of this is people looking at linguistic phonics and saying things like, well, because it doesn't have this syllable type stuff, this must mean it's like radically better, like transformatively better. And I don't think there's any evidence or necessarily any, you know, logical underpinning to suggest that it is likely to be, you know, transformative to move to linguistic phonics from something else. I do think that different programs potentially are a little bit more efficient or more effective than others potentially, but I don't think they perfectly align with, you know, linguistic phonics versus traditional phonics. Just the final thing that I need to say to prevent linguistic phonics types like getting in touch with hate mail is that the essence of linguistic phonics comes from the researcher Diane McGuinness and her prototype that she spelled out in the book Early Reading Instruction, which I've read repeatedly because it's a really fascinating book. And it was one of the early books that really got me into reading research. And there are elements of that that make linguistic phonics like a little bit different from what you might think of speech to print more generally. So one of those things is that They think it's a terrible idea generally to say that letters make sounds or letters say sounds. They think that that's misleading. Again, personally, I don't think that's problematic from personal experience. I think kids deal with metaphors all the time. You know, if you say that the clock is saying that it's 4 o'clock, I don't have kids saying to me, but clocks can't talk. It's and they'll often talk about pupils with certain conditions and say, oh, well, I've got these kids that think very literally. And it's like, I've taught kids both traditional phonics programs and linguistic phonics programs. Nah, this is something you're just saying for effect. The other thing, and probably the most controversial bit of linguistic phonics, is the idea very often that you shouldn't teach the names of letters at the same time as you're teaching initial speech sounds. Again, there's no real research into this specifically. There's research that suggests there's like correlations that unsurprisingly suggest that kids who arrive at school already knowing the names of letters tend to learn to read more quickly. But we shouldn't be surprised by that because there's all sorts of other things that might be behind that. Personally, I think it is fairly sensible to not be teaching letter names it on the same days or in the same in the same lessons as you are first introducing kids to speech sounds, if they don't already know these letter names. It can be confusing. A kid can get to a word like cat and say, C-A-T. Is that C-A-T? It's like, no, it's cat. And so there are some reasons why you might think it's sensible not to teach letter names at the same time. But in the real world, by the time most kids actually do start to learn phonics, the vast majority of your class already do know letter names from nursery or from home or from watching Sesame Street or whatever it might be. So I think often this is an argument again that comes down to marketing and trying to sell linguistic phonics programs as very special and very different and considerably more effective. Again, there's a huge amount of information there. Feel free to unpack it and ask me any questions if there's stuff that I've not made clear.
What you're sort of making me think about is just that, like, when you design a program, and let's get the commercial interest out of the way, because this is sort of underneath all of this are people that have their preferred program that they maybe work for them, or they've used it in the past, and they don't see, they just saw it was really effective, and they're just kind of positive about it. Underneath all this, it's just like you can run a different analysis. Like I'm thinking of a paper. I'll link it in the show notes if I remember. A paper that was explaining when Engelmann redid the analysis of reading mastery, and because folks didn't like the funny letters, so he redid and created a new program without the funny letters. And in which case, he started by teaching the alphabet, where in Reading Mastery you taught the alphabet quite a bit later, and he explains all the choices. And it just seems to me people are overstating that maybe there's an evidence base behind one of these analyses over another, when in the end of the day, you end up doing the spelling and you're doing the word work and the writing, and you're doing a lot of the elements of both speech to print and print to speech in most phonics programs. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the big differences is that people will say something like, oh, well, yeah, the thing about speech to print programs is there's lots of spelling involved and you've got to get kids spelling. And I totally agree that we've got to get kids doing loads of spelling because then you're teaching segmenting, which is a great way to embed blending, the reverse of that. So it's great for reading and it's great for writing. So totally on board with that. But I'm from a country where there's a whole ton of programs that wouldn't define themselves as speech to print. And all of them, by definition, because the government demands it, have a ton of spelling in them. So often what happens here is people point to stuff and say, this is really useful. And I agree. And then they suggest or imply that this only exists in this version of phonics. And I can often say, well, that's not true. Here's another program that would define itself as print to speech that still has a load of spelling or whatever or whatever individual thing it might be. More importantly than that, though, having seen quite a few different phonics programs, the big differences are, for me at least, much less about like scope and sequence organization and the minutiae around that. It comes down much more down to Well, does the teacher really know what they're doing? Are they able to move at pace? Are the routes do the routines include really clear modelling and lots of opportunities for practice? Is formative assessment built in? So from the very beginning, I can start to say, yeah, I need to give a little bit more time and input to this pupil or this little group of pupils. That stuff for me matters far more than any form of like the way that it's organised. Or to put it more bluntly, like the linguistic phonics program that I'm most familiar with is Sounds Right. I would happily teach that. I would happily teach that to a class of kids, to an individual, to a group of kids. I've never taught Youfly, which by the looks from what I've seen of the manual, looks a lot like a traditional, if you like, print to speech program. I've looked at that. I'd happily teach that all day to a group, to an individual, to a group of kids, or to a whole class of kids. And so when people get really riled up about like the sides of this debate, yes, there are maybe inefficient practices to pick apart, like the teaching of syllable types, which I don't think is particularly useful. But the much bigger fish to fry come down to like the efficiency of instruction. And in the case of something like that linguistic phonics program I was talking about a moment ago, and Youfly, they both look pretty efficient to me. I'd be perfectly happy to teach either of them. And I'd gamble that they'll both do fairly well compared to programs that are, to my mind, less efficient, but from the opposite category.
Absolutely. And that kind of transitions us to the last bit of this show, which was to go into storytelling mode. StepLab was looking for the most sensible and practical literacy consultant they could find in the whole of the world, and they came to you to sort of design some resources and action steps for coaches and principals and so on. You've been working with them to help that aspect out, which you just mentioned. Like, often enough, the delivery and the pacing and the fact that you're teaching kids to repeat until firm and actually master it within a lesson, and you go back and you make sure you delay test kids and all that stuff matters so much. As you've been working on kind of action steps for teachers, yeah, what have you been working on, and what comes to mind?
So the first thing to say about that is you mentioned that they approached, the most sensible, et cetera. I can't guarantee that I wasn't like number 25 on the list and everyone else had better things to do, but I will take the compliment regardless. In essence, I've spent the last few years working with primary schools, but also working with secondary schools in a lot of circumstances as well, talking about, well, what does post-phonics reading instruction look like? Because we've been talking almost entirely about phonics in this podcast. And yet, a lot of the problems that exist are about what comes next, what follows that. There are lots of schools that teach phonics really well, but you don't see that translate into really good outcomes in terms of comprehension and, dare I say, even like volitional reading for a whole variety of reasons. And so, a lot of what I've been doing over the last few years is working with schools to say, well, what can we do? What does the next steps that follow phonics, that might start from age 6 but continue up to like age 16 and beyond, like what does that look like? And a big part of that, and this will be me very briefly repeating something I said in the last time I was on, is that ultimately I think it can be boiled down to three things. We need to ensure that pupils become fluent readers, and that means scaffolded decoding, scaffolded reading practice, and experiences of what it's like to be a fluent reader. Second thing is we need to make sure we're building pupils' understanding of written language and the wider world through a breadth of pacey, meaningful, and very often, I like to think, enjoyable, invigorating experiences with texts. And the third thing we need to be doing is we need to be engaging pupils in deeper text discussions so that at times we can explicitly teach important aspects of the linguistic structures within writing, but also so that we can support pupils to develop their own identity as readers, recognize what they enjoy, recognize that there are subjective elements to reading, but also that there are strategic elements to reading. You need to take a certain degree of responsibility to deal with tricky texts. And so these three things form the basis of another core of a book that I wrote called Primary Reading Simplified, and I've used it with primary schools. I've spoken to a lot of secondary schools, and ultimately these three things form the basis of three goals within StepLab. So three things that you might want to do as a reading teacher. You might want to develop your pupils' reading fluency. You might want to be providing a pacey, meaningful reading experience, or you might be wanting to dive into like a more analytical discussion of text. And where do we begin with that? How do we do it? Well, what we've been doing with StepLab is taking those goals and dividing them up into a set of steps that teachers can work on one at a time. And within those steps, there are really clear success criteria. Like, if you're going to do this well, these are the things you need to do. And crucially, I was videoed, as were others, another teacher. And the videos that we've made are part of that, are part of those steps. So it isn't just the case of, you know, I advocate doing this. There's a little bit of me putting my money where my mouth is and saying, and this is what it looks like. A big part of that, I think, is demystifying it. The last thing I want, and this might sound counterintuitive, the last thing I want is anyone to watch a video of me doing a bit of teaching and go, wow, that's incredibly impressive. How do I possibly do that? What I want, and what I imagine is the case, is people will see the steps within StepLab and go, oh, is that all it is? I think I can do that. That's totally achievable. Very often, the gap is around understanding it, what it is you need to do, putting it into, like, practicing a little bit of it. And obviously, this is what StepLab is really useful for in coaching, because you can work with your coach, you can identify what it is you're going to work on, you can practice it, and then put it into practice in the classroom. But very often, it is just the case of, oh, I didn't know that that would align with that goal. So in short, the work I've been doing with StepLab is creating these steps within these reading goals, the success criteria that are associated with them. I've been filmed so that we've provided like basic models for all of this stuff. And also for each of these reading goals, so, you know, developing fluency and providing a kind of reading with sustained momentum and getting into like an analytical exploration of text. For each of those three, I've also written a really kind of brief primer on not just the research, but also what the accumulated wisdom of the profession might suggest about those three goals and how we might go about achieving them.
I love it. And you know, here in the United States, there are so many folks that find themselves like full-time literacy coaches, reading coaches, and they spend a lot of time just managing resources and not really able to like do the job that they thought they were signing up for, and they don't feel very successful, and they need this library of resources, just like you'd give a great, you know, phonics program to a teacher. They need these resources, and they've been dying and asking me for that for the last few years. I'm really excited. I'm really excited to see when's it launched, you know?
Pretty soon. I think it's like literally the next 2 or 3 weeks. It's on the way. I've got a webinar with StepLab on Monday. I don't know whether that's going to be recorded, etc. So get the chance to talk about that work in a little more depth. But just a final thing to say about it is that when I originally wrote this part of my book and then the steps with StepLab, these were explicitly designed with the idea in mind that these aren't things that are just for primary teachers. These are not just things that, oh, well, this is great for someone in grade four, but what about, you know, grade seven, grade eight? These are things that pupils in a lot of cases will need to work on. If you are a teacher with older pupils, you may well have a class where actually reading fluency is the thing holding them back from being able to engage with texts. Or equally, you might say, well, I teach English language arts, and one of the things I really need to do is to get kids engaged with this longer book that we're going to be reading together. But when I read it, I don't feel like it really lands, or I don't know how and when to pause to explain vocabulary, or I don't know when's the most appropriate moment to perhaps summarize or to ask a quick question, or how often I might do that. This at least provides, I think, a really sensible jumping off point for anyone who is looking to advance the quality of the teaching of reading around these different things, and crucially connects it to a purpose. It's really easy to end up thinking, oh, how do I teach reading? Once you're beyond phonics, you really have to start to think about, well, what am I trying to achieve here? Is the goal developing fluency? Is the goal, you know, a pacey, meaningful reading experience? Is the goal explicitly talking about aspects of language? Because then, once you've got that goal in mind, you can work out what applies to you, what applies to your class. And yeah, ultimately, I hope that that's what StepLab's going to be helpful with.
Awesome. Chris, you are invited to come back on anytime. Really, I just would love to have like these ongoing sort of like your talks about what you're learning and reading. Folks, thank you so much for tuning in to Progressively Incorrect. Please give it a 5-star and, you know, pass it around and such. I'll be sure to keep on churning out these episodes, about one a week. Chris, take care.
Thanks, Zach. It was an absolute pleasure once again.